Welcome. Today is May 7th. Beautiful sunny day. We will be continuing on with our E12 conference committee. Today, before we start, I'd like to introduce my intern who was here today. And Corey, if you could just stand up and say a word or two about yourself. Thank you, Corey. So we are very glad to have him working on our staff. So what I thought we'd do today is we'll do a little bit of follow-up with a couple of the handouts, a couple of questions that we didn't quite have all the information for yesterday. We'll also talk about the levies. We didn't get a chance to talk about that part of the education finance. And then we'll do a bill walkthrough. So one of the first things I believe we spoke about was the Department of Minnesota's information regarding percent change in the average state pupil aid as compared to the cost of inflation, both in real dollars and inflation-adjusted dollars. And so we have just 10 of those copies, so if we can make sure they just all get to members, that'd be helpful. And, of course, there's always more available. But take a look at those. It just shows the cost in real dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, and then it also shows the average per pupil cost per year, both in real dollars and in inflation dollars. Then a second topic that we mentioned briefly had to do with the Center Perpich for the Arts, and I see we have a few more copies of this. And this takes through how the calculation was made regarding Perpich Center for the Arts, and you will recall that there's an appropriation for the total fixed operating costs, which you will see there on line 13. And then you will see that their maximum enrollment level is 310 students, and that's what we've been paying for, but their estimated pupil count is 112 students. And so after the fixed operating costs, the Senate's position then is to pay for students on the average per pupil cost. And so we have an itemization of that for you as well. And I should see if there's any questions about either of those two things, I guess, before we leave those. The next item then is the levy tracker. Yes.
Madam Chair, in the follow-up from yesterday category, you had raised a question about why the Dayton administration had sunsetted the provision for equality in funding of the BIE schools, the four BIE schools. And what I learned is that the Dayton administration proposal was for that to be ongoing. It was the former House majority that sunsetted it. So just to get the record straight on that one.
Thank you, Chair Gavney. It's always good for us to look at those historical things, so I appreciate that. So then the last piece of finance that we didn't have a chance to talk about yesterday was the levy trackers. And so while there are not an inordinate amount of levy changes, I know the Senate we worked, that was one of our priorities, was not to increase property taxes. And if we could start with our fiscal analyst to get us onto those levy trackers, please. Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As we did yesterday, Ms. Adrians and I will take turns walking through the levy tracker for you to discuss the Senate and House proposals. So the spreadsheet that you'll be looking at today in the top left corner on the second line, it's marked property tax tracking. In the upper right-hand corner, it's time-stamped May 4th, 2019 at 2:05 p.m. So it looks like members have had a chance to find that document. So just to briefly orient you to the spreadsheet, The columns across the top are all indicated with a letter. You can see a mixture of the base years from the February forecast. Those would be columns A, B, G, and L. So those represent the February forecasted levies. And then you'll also see columns for the Senate proposal and the Senate proposal compared to current law, as well as the House proposal and the House proposal compared to current law. So those would be the shaded columns. Going down the left-hand side of the page, you're going to have line numbers indicating each program. The levy tracker here is sorted based on the fund to which the levy is credited at the school district level. Most of these interactions you'll see will take place in the general fund. I believe, looking over the spreadsheet, yes, all of them are for the general fund. So I will just quickly start with the Senate proposal. So there is only actually one levy change in the Senate E-12 bill, and this would be a swap, actually, of where some local district levies are tracked. Under current law, $300 of the referendum levy is board-approved. The Senate took the governor's provision, which suggested that that $300 of board-approved referendum levy instead be categorized as local optional to make it easier for districts to administer both levies and to make it clear to the voters what exactly was being proposed and voted on. So you can see that on lines 16 and 28. If you go over to column C and D, you'll see the Senate's proposed increase of $168,609,000 in the pay 2020 year. And if you go down to line 28, you'll see an equal reduction to the referendum levy. If you go over to column I, you can see the $176.4 million increase to the local optional on line 16. And down on line 28, you'll see an equal reduction for pay 2021 to referendum. And then finally, in column N, on line 16, you'll see an increase to local optional of $183.5 million in pay 2022 and an equal reduction on line 28 to referendum on line 28 of $183.5 million. The House also carries this proposal, but the numbers are a little bit different because of another levy change that Ms. Adrians will talk about. And then one final thing that I was asked to speak about on line 29, you'll see the referendum equalization. While this proposal is carried in the Senate's tax bill, it's shown here in brackets. And yesterday, Chair Davney did ask a question about the aid interactions that we were tracking on the change item sheet and why it was that the amounts were so similar for the Senate and the House bill, even though the Senate proposal would reduce equalization, increase equalization by a smaller amount. And in reviewing the revenue estimates from the Department of Revenue, Ms. Adrians and I found that we were tracking them slightly differently. So with the referendum equalization, there's two tax impacts. So first, the property tax refunds are impacted. So that would primarily be the homestead refund credit. And then the income taxes are also impacted. And typically with those, the E-12 division would be tracking the property tax interaction, and the tax division would be tracking the income tax. Because both were carried in the tax jurisdiction, the Senate bundled those together, and the Senate is then tracking a different number from the House. The House is tracking just the property tax refund. So going forward on the next version of the spreadsheet, we will include a separate line that breaks those two out so it's more clear to the committee what's being tracked in the E-12 jurisdiction versus the tax jurisdiction. So, and with that, I can turn it over to Ms. Adrians to go through the House changes.
Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As Hofer referenced, the House carries the similar provision that the Senate does, and the reason that the numbers are just slightly different for that local optional line on line 16, the House also carries the provision to maintain the voluntary pre-K, the funding for the fiscal 19 levels. So there are a number of areas where the levy lines change because of the voluntary pre-K, and I don't I'm not going to show every single line, but there are, you can see that there are a number of the shaded lines. So for instance, on line 19, the transition, that is a change. On line 20, the equity, and so forth. So there are a number of levy changes that are a result of the voluntary pre-K change. And what the House bill does is, rather than have the increase in the levy tracking for that, it pays for it in state aid, with state aid. And so So the bottom line for the levy tracking for the House is zero net effect because of the voluntary pre-K change. Now, what the House does do in the levy tracking, if you look at line 29 for the referendum equalization that is similar to the House, or I'm sorry, the tax bill in the Senate, the reduction of $25 million, and you'll see that in both columns E and F, on line 29, and then the $25 million carries forward into the fiscal year 22. This is column J and K. You'll see that negative $25 million, and then in columns O and P as well. And what the House does is the bill increases the second-tier equalizing factor of the referendum revenue from $510,000 to $650,000. And so this results in the lower levy from the House bill. The other thing that I would like to point out, Madam Chair and members, on the levy tracking is if you'll look at down on lines 74 and 75, as we spoke about yesterday, the House bill provides aid for the cooperatives and then also funding for Hopkins, the authorization for the Hopkins School District to merge with a charter school. And so on lines 74 and 75, these are the increases in those levy. For the co-ops, it's $139,000 every year starting in fiscal year 21. And then for the Hopkins levy increase, it's an increase of $50,000 every year starting in fiscal year 21 as well. But if you'll look up at line 56, this is the levy offset, so it's a net of $189,000. That's reduced to balance out those levy increases so that the net effect in the levy tracking is zero. And again, those are paid for with state aid rather than levy.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. I believe you answered my question, but I just want to be clear then. Are there any distribution effects in the House levies that would impact property taxes in any way, for example, in Hopkins?
Madam Chair, members, not to my knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. And then the cost for that is a state aid cost of how much did you say that state aid cost was, Ms. Adrians?
Madam Chair, for the Hopkins increase, it's $50,000 annually.
And the aid for co-ops is $139,000 annually.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, that's correct.
And then, so that is the only state aid. Is there any other state aid interactions with the pieces that I think are tied to the VPK? So I'm looking at those lines as well now.
Correct.
Ms. Adrians.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the voluntary pre-K program, the funding, the total funding in the House bill for that program is just over $47 million in fiscal year 20 and 21 for the biennium. And that includes that aid offset, that it's all included in that amount.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians.
Yeah.
And Mr. Arneson, do you have some further comments on either the levies or the state aid piece? Mr.
Arneson? Madam Chair, I just think that the House proposal, while at a statewide level, probably results in net zero change on the levy tracker. I can't help but believe that there's probably some district-level movement, you know, plus or minus. Relative to the House's Safe Schools proposal, for example,
the Hopkins proposal, as you indicated, and perhaps others.
Thank you, Mr. Arnison. It would be helpful if we could get those run on these particular levy interactions. So I also wonder too how the referendum equalization might affect either some districts' property taxes, moving that tier two from $510 to $650. $1,000. So just if we could get those that for our next meeting, that'd be really helpful. Thank you. Thank you so much. Any further comments on the levy tracker or questions? Okay. Thank you. What we thought we would spend the most of our time today on is walking through the bill summary, and we'll have our staff start with that. And I was debating about questions and when that might be the best time to do that, and I thought about waiting till the end of the article, but I think our articles we might lose a lot in the conversation, so we'll try and take those questions as they come. So let's allow our staff to walk through the presentations, and then we'll walk through the bill. So we'll go through the bill itself so we can actually see the language in that bill and be familiar with the differences, and then we'll take our questions. So who would be starting with that? Mr. Strom. I forgot the last name. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Mr. Arneson and I will be walking through Article 1 for you. There's two documents you may want to reference. Whichever works better for you is the one you should feel free to use. There's a side-by-side bill summary with the House provisions on the left and the Senate provisions on the right, and a comparison column in the middle. And then there's the language itself, which is what I'll be using to work from. The language, again, House appears on the left in this version and Senate on the right. At the bottom of the pages, they all start with the initial R for the reviser. It lists the page number and then is followed by dash A with a number, and that's for the article number. So to keep your article page numbers straight, in Article 1, the trailing digits on those will be an A1. So, Madam Chair, I'll try to go as quickly as possible. We'll switch back and forth for House and Senate provisions, and just holler if there are questions. Madam Chair, members, the first couple of sections of the House bill go together. These have to do with the state budget reserve. Currently, there's a list of five things that are in statute for how future reserves would be dedicated. The House proposes to add two new categories. The first of those is for special education funding. Currently, there's a separate age shift for special education funding, and these funds are not paid on the usual 90-10%, but paid at a somewhat smaller percentage at an 88% with some trailing digits percent. A one-time addition of state money there, if there were a budget surplus, would use about $37 million of the budget surplus and would put the special education funding payment schedule the same as for districts. That's no new revenue for districts, but it's a funding shift and a one-time shift. The second provision, which shows up in the new Clause 6, is a payment of $50 million of the budget reserve, of future surpluses in the budget reserve, to be transferred to school districts for compensation for past underpayments from the permanent school fund due to land use restrictions. And there's a section that details that payment in some detail later in the bill.
Mr. Strom, just a question, particularly on those two pieces. Talk about our school trust lands and our requirement to pay those back. And I'm just wondering if the House had discussions in regards to the budget reserve. The House proposal seeks to add up to $50 million of any reserves to our school districts directly. And then we also have this competing interest in paying back the school trust lands. And maybe I should be asking the members about if there were any discussion on that and maybe how the health.
Madam Chair, let me set the background, but probably best to ask the members for that. The initial provision with special education was Representative Carlson's provision, and there was a fair portion of Education Finance Committee hearings set aside for that discussion. The permanent school fund payment provision came as a House floor amendment this year and was not discussed in the committee process.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Chair Daphne.
The provision six on the school trust lands was a Representative O'Driscoll amendment on the floor, as Mr. Strom indicated, and he's been very involved in the school trust land issues for the years that he's been in the legislature, I believe.
Thank you. I know that's a discussion that we've had in different spots in the Senate as well, so there's some issues where our first priority must be, I think. And I don't know if constitutionally if there's a requirement there, but that's something we'll need to take a look at. Mr. Strom, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the next section lines up in the House and Senate with a one-word error difference on the House side. House Section 3 and Senate Section 1 deal with the transportation of homeless students and essentially requires that a school district that's the first transporting district for the year continue to arrange homeless students' transportations for that student if the student's attending an intermediate program for the remainder of that school year. So even if the responsibility resides still with the resident school district, if the serving district switches, the first serving district would, for the remainder of that school year, be responsible for arranging that transportation services. And the House just had a typo and referred to an individual educational plan instead of the program. Section 4 is a separate provision related to the enrollment of students in foster care, and this provision requires that on line 5.4 requires that the student must be enrolled in a new school within 7 days. Section 5 is a provision related to the absence from school for religious reasons and requires school boards to provide an annual notice to parents regarding the school district's policy related to student absences for religious observances. The provision also allows the school district to satisfy the notice requirement by including that information in the handbook. The next section, Section 6, relates to the school calendar and authorizes school districts to consider the community's religious observances when they adopt the annual school calendar. Section 7 is one of a series of provisions that's related to that you'll see later in the bill related to the compulsory instruction aid and clarifies that that school districts are responsible for maintaining a program of all grades, including kindergarten, beginning with the 2021 school year. Section 8 relates to the school board when making an offer of employment to a prospective employee, requires the board before doing so to request a copy of the personnel file from the former employing district or charter school if that potential employee had worked for one previously. Section 9 in the House bill makes technical changes to the superintendent's role when working with the school board. None of those changes should have a substantive effect. Section 10 in the House bill and Section 2 of the Senate bill relate to the treatment of textbooks for non-public schools. These provisions are the same and are similar to the language that was in last year's bill that allows the textbooks that are provided to non-public schools to include a teacher's edition or a teacher's guide or other materials if those are somehow packaged in with the textbooks that the school would prefer to choose. Section 11 of the House provision and 3 of the Senate are the same and also relate to this same issue as do Section 12 and of the House and Section 4 of the Senate.
Madam Chair, on page R7 is the first Senate-only provision in Section 5. Actually, it is related to 5, 6, and 7 on the Senate side. And this would provide that elementary or secondary pupils enrolled in American Indian Controlled Tribal Contract or grant schools, sometimes we call them BIE schools, would be eligible to obtain guidance and counseling services from the district in which the school is located. On the bottom of page R8, section 8.
Madam Chair, Ms. Robinson, if I may.
Chair.
Just wondering, section 5 that Mr. Arneson just described, does that show up on the spreadsheet as well? What's the cost associated with school districts providing that service to BIE schools in their districts?
Ms. Hofer, do you have that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Davney. So that would show up on the change item tracker as well as the state aid tracker within the general education article. And that is going to show up on the change item sheet on, let's see, it's line 17, the non-public pupil aid for tribal contract students. So that would be $188,000 for the first biennium and $250,000 for the TALES.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Ms. Hofer, could you repeat the first year, please?
Yes, $188,000 for the first biennium and $250,000 for the TALES.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Arnett.
Madam Chair, continuing on the bottom of page R8, House Section 13 and Senate Section 8 are the same, with the exception of the effective date, and originate from the governor's proposal, and this clarifies the school board control over certain accounts related to extracurricular activities.
Madam Chair, members, the next provision is Section 14 of the House bill, beginning on the bottom of page R9. This provision creates a new category of pupil transportation aid for certain school districts that provide regular transportation of pregnant teens and their children to and from a school program, a qualifying school program. And that's a program that has at least 4 hours of parenting training a week, a high-quality child care on site, and and the program was in existence as of January 2018 or will be in operation for new programs after July 1st, 2021.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, the next Senate-only provision is on page R13, Section 7. This is the provision that Ms. Hofer described yesterday that authorizes a 10th grade non-public pupil to participate in the dual credit programs for certain CTE courses. Continuing on R13, Section 13 on the Senate side, increases the number of families for whom transportation reimbursement for PSEO courses is available. Under current law, in order to be eligible for reimbursement, the student's family income has to be at or below the federal poverty level, and this would increase that threshold to 185% of the federal poverty level. And further, in paragraph C on page R14, clarifies, and I believe this is consistent with current department practice, but clarifies that transportation costs eligible for reimbursement under this section include costs of transportation in a private car or public transportation or other shared vehicle.
Thank you. Mr. Staub?
Madam Chair, members, the next section at the bottom of page R14 is the career and technical revenue change of the House. The House provision beginning in 2021 increases the reimbursement rate from 35 to 50% of the school district's eligible qualifying career and technical expenses. Thank you for asking the question on the distribution of the taxes. As Ms. Adrians mentioned, the House provision, the career and technical program, is primarily a levy program. The House provision pays for the increase through increased equalization aid, and there will be distributional changes. And Ms. Adrians and I have a series of printouts that we'll be glad to bring down later today so you can see which districts are benefiting from the added equalization aid on those provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma. We'll look forward to that.
Madam Chair, members, the next provision is Section 16, and this has to do with English learner revenue. There's two parts to this formula. The basic English learner revenue is currently set at $704 times the number of English learners enrolled in the school district. The House proposes to increase this amount to $740 beginning in fiscal year 20. Section 17 of the House bill is similar to the provision we talked about for school boards earlier. This is codified in the charter school statute and requires a charter school before hiring a teacher to make a request of that person's personnel file from any previous employing district or charter school. Madam Chair, members, there's a series of provisions starting in Section 18 that all have to do with local optional revenue. Essentially, the House and the Senate have picked up the proposal of the governors to take the first tier, the first $300 of referendum revenue out of the referendum and move it, because that revenue can be board approved, and to move that over into the local optional revenue category. So there's about six or seven provisions here that all do the same thing. These sections are implicated as well with a few other changes that are not the same, and we'll point out where those occur. But essentially what's happening is there's no change in aid or levy for school districts, but it would change the amount of the referendum question that's asked by moving the $300 of board approved authority out to the out to the local optional revenue. But there would be no aid or levy change. It would affect the dollar value that appears on the ballot. Madam Chair, members, Section 19 is the House formula allowance increase. The House proposes a 3% increase in the first year and a 2% increase in the second year.
Madam Chair, the Senate proposes amending the same section. Section 15, Senate proposes a 0.5% increase for fiscal 20 and an additional 0.5% increase for fiscal 21 and later.
Madam Chair, members, Section 20 at the bottom of page R17 on the House side has to do with the kindergarten count. Right now, because of the way that the full-day kindergarten went into effect, there's still a separate count of kindergarten students for the kindergarten disabled students. This is a cross-reference to that count in the declining enrollment revenue statute. If that provision were not adopted, there's no need for the cross-reference fix here. And Section 21 is another of the local optional revenue provisions that we discussed a few moments ago. Section 22 on page R18 has to do with a provision in the compensatory education revenue that sets aside a portion in 2017. A provision was passed beginning on lines 19.32 that requires school districts to reserve a portion of their compensatory revenue for extended time services only. The House proposes to delete that language.
Just a couple of questions on that. And also going forward, if we could have the fiscal cost as you described the different sections to us, if there's a fiscal cost, I think it would help us just get all of those pieces together.
Sure.
Policy and the cost in one place. But to the compensatory education revenue, I was curious as to, one, if there was a fiscal, if there was any fiscal cost on that. I don't know that there would be, but I would want to know if there was some interaction that I'm not aware of on the fiscal side, but on the policy side, I'm just curious why the House might have chosen to remove the requirement to use that increase for extended time revenue. Chair Dappy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This proposal doesn't change the formula in any way. So there's not a fiscal change there. I guess it depends on your position on local control and whether we should allow school boards to make the decision within the fences we've already built around compensatory aid and its uses. I think, if I remember, there are 10 allowed uses, 9, 10, something like that, that they may choose from, or whether we should direct them to only use increases for a certain use.
And has there been a look at, because I do recall this was a provision from, I think, the last budget cycle, because mm-hmm. there had been some data that showed that the extended time use really increases student achievement. And so I'm just curious if there's been a look at any data on student achievement in regards to compensatory use for extended time as opposed to other uses.
You know, Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of, but of course allowing school districts the flexibility to use the compensatory as they see most impactful with their student population and in their community, I think is the direction we were wanting to go.
And thank you. I think that would be something important for us to look at, too. We always try and have data-driven decisions. And so if we do have, I'm not sure that we do, but if we do have data on how extended time has been used, and we could also do, I know there's been some call to look at compensatory education funding in general to see how those compensatory dollars are affecting student achievement, because that's always our top goal. So that's something we might come back to if we have the ability to look at any data that might help with that discussion.
Sure. You know, Madam Chair, of course, we'd have to look at, to really do our jobs fully, we'd need to look at data related to each of the possible uses of
yes.
of compensatory aid, because it's not just is extended time beneficial. I'll throw in. Yeah. But so are the other uses. And so it's at least a two-part question. What's the data on the other uses to compare? And then how much do we trust our locally elected school boards and our locally hired superintendents to make the decision? Or do we think we're in a better position to make the decision for them?
Thank you. I do think that's something we can continue. And it could be something, too, perhaps we might want to ask the OLA to take a look at that, too, to really, because I think it is a broader question. It's a very important question because we spend a significant amount of time dollars on compensatory revenue. And really, those oftentimes are the very school districts and students that we want to make sure that we can see that growth in achievement. And I think it could be a good way to help us eliminate achievement gaps. And so I don't know if we'll be able to do it before May 20th, but something we should definitely put on our watch list is how are those compensatory dollars best used for our children. So thank you for that discussion. Any further questions on compensatory or extended time revenue? All right. We'll continue on then. I think Mr. Strong. Operating capital.
Madam Chair, members, Section 23, Operating Capital Levy. The House adjusts the operating capital levy for the factors that Ms. Adrian's mentioned, those related to the VPK as well as the small other levy increases that the House authorized that are brought down here to make the net levy change zero. There's no revenue impact from these. There would be a very small distributional impact with the slightly higher operating capital equalizing factor. Madam Chair, members, on page R19, section 24 is the second part of the change for the transportation of pregnant teens and their children to and from school programs. The fiscal cost of this provision is about $60,000 a year. Section 25 of the House and 17 of the Senate are part of the change for the local optional revenue that we talked about earlier. Section 26 of the House is the elimination of the separate count, or I'm sorry, is the is elimination of some old language regarding the use of general education revenue for full-day kindergarten. This is a provision that existed prior to the passage of full-day kindergarten. Section 27 of the House and 28 of the Senate are the same related to local optional revenue. On page R22, section 28 of the House and 19 of the Senate are also the same regarding local optional revenue, as is section 29 of the House and section 20 of the Senate. In section 30 of the House, the provision starts right at the very bottom of page R23. This is the change in the equalization aid on line 25.28. The higher equalizing factor of $650,000, which now becomes the first year of referendum equalization, that compares to the former factor of $510,000. That has a cost on the aid side of $25 million. on a 100% entitlement basis and saves the school districts that same amount on the local levy, the $25 million of local levy. The impact of that, as the chair asked earlier, there would be a distributional impact under this provision. Nobody is has higher taxes, but those that are under $650,000 of tax base per pupil would be the districts that benefit. So no one's taxes go up under this, but there would be a distributional impact for those whose taxes go down. The Senate may want to speak to what's in their tax bill, but this change, as I mentioned, would cost about $25 million a year in state aid.
So, Mr. Strom, those are the runs that will, some of the runs.
Madam Chair, yes. We've got a printout on that we'd be glad to bring.
Madam Chair, do you want me to briefly describe the kind of complementary provision in that?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Mr. Armstrong.
So the Senate proposes to increase referendum equalization also, but carries that provision in the tax bill. And the tax provision would increase what is currently first-tier referendum equalization from the $880,000 factor to, I think, $900,000 in the tax bill. And that provides a little bit of equalization in Tier 1 and will provide some tax reductions for most districts under Tier 1. The Senate in Tiers 2 and 3, well, what are now Tiers 2 and 3 in current law, proposes a sort of alternative calculation of the equalized levy, which takes into account not only the district's resident adjusted pupil units, but also the district's resident pupil units in the current law and adjusted pupil units in the proposed law. So the effect of this is to increase equalization, especially for districts that tend to have a net positive influx of open enrolling students. Under the current law, if a district takes in a lot of open enrolling students, they look relatively more wealthy when the resident pupil units are in the denominator of the equalizing factor. And the Senate proposes to allow a district to calculate its equalized levy on the what's more advantageous to the district, whether that's calculating on the basis of resident pupil units or adjusted pupil units. So that's the Senate tax provision in a nutshell. And I like Mr. Strom and House staff, we do have runs to display the impacts of that at a district level and share that if needed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Arnson. I think it'll be important for us to look at those runs as well. So, thank you. Let's see, who's next?
Madam Chair, members, on page R25, the House and Senate both amend the same provision of statute but with quite different intents. The House side I'll speak to on Section 33, this is the referendum revenue. The House provision allows a school board by resolution for new referendums that pass after July 1st of this year to renew those for the same dollar amount by school board resolution. So in other words, if the district were to pass a school district were to pass a new referendum after July 1st of this year, if that were a 10-year referendum, the board in 10 years could renew that referendum at the same dollar amount.
And Madam Chair, on page R25, Senate Section 24, right near the bottom, there was a floor amendment to from the chair to respond to a request from the School Board Association that the required notice in advance of a referendum election be delivered by mail at least 15 but no more than 45 days before the day of the referendum. And I understood this to be in response partly to the increased prevalence of early voting in some of these elections. And maybe I'll continue on to the next page, page R26. On the Senate side, in the middle of the page, the new language there was amended on to the bill on the floor from Senator Westrom and clarifies that the required notice that I mentioned earlier or any other school communication may not advocate in favor or against passage of the operating referendum.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson.
Madam Chair, members, Section 34 of the House bill is the remainder of the renewal of the referendum, the new language for the renewal of a referendum that's passed after July 1st. You can see the conditions that must be made there. The ballot has to state when initially passed that it could be renewed in the future by a school board. The per pupil amount has to be the same. The term has to be the same, and the school district must adopt a written resolution after holding a meeting to discuss the renewal before the referendum could be renewed by a school board. There's a reverse referendum requirement that a petition could be filed if it were signed by 25% of the registered voters in the district, in which case then the district would be required to hold a referendum on that provision.
Madam Chair, over here.
Here's someone.
Oh. Yeah. thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, my apologies for being late. I was at the other committee that I'm in. I don't know if our questions in order to understand some of the language, is that appropriate at this time?
Yes, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I actually had wanted to go back to the prior reference, Senator, this is on page R26, I guess, and the language added by Senator Westrom on the floor about the school district not advocating in favor of or against passage of the referendum. And I'm just wondering if there are there any other restrictions similar to this that would apply even without this language. And I guess I'm thinking that when my own school district sends out, or any that I've seen, when there's a levy referendum, they seem to be careful to not say to act in favor or against. I just am wondering if staff knows if there's any other restriction besides this language that would restrict a school district in terms of advocating for or against a referendum.
Representative Pinto, before our staff can answer that, I'll just give a little bit of a background in how this appeared. So as Senator Westrom talked to me about this amendment, I said, well, that's already current law. And that was my experience. Our school districts are very careful about using taxpayer dollars to advocate for referendum. And I was wrong, actually. We have a statement from our state auditor about a position. It's a statement of position on expenditure of public funds on ballot issue advocacy. Currently, what I think most of us thought was current law, actually, there was a court case that kind of put this into turmoil. And so it seems like it's a little bit unclear at this point. And so while I thought the Westrom Amendment was simply reiterating what current law is, it appears that there seems to be uncertainty. And we will be glad to pass out a copy of this as well so everyone has a copy of that. But I think staff may have some other things to add to that as well. Mr. Arneson.
Madam Chair, I think you summarized it, and if members obtain a copy of the auditor's memo, I think more will become clear.
Thank you, and we'll provide that for our next meeting. So very good question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to know that you and I are have that same reaction.
Yes. Rep. Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, I would like be great to see some of that, because I know the Supreme Court or the Appellate Court actually took a pass on answering this question and focused more on whether or not they violated campaign finance rules. So I think they took a pass because the underlying law already says that districts can't use money to do before or against. So I think that it'd be interesting to see the OLA's thoughts on that, because that's not how the court case quite reads. Yes.
So I will take some time, look at this, and kind of go over this. But, again, I was a bit surprised myself. So if it's a matter of clarifying what we believe is in current law, then that's something the Senate thinks we should do. So we'll continue with that. Thank you very much. Thank you for those good copies. Talk about fast on your feet. We appreciate that. Let's see. Who is up next? Representative Pinto, did you have any further questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Next.
Mr. Arneson. Madam Chair, I think we're on to page R28, which would be Senate Section 25. And this provision would allow for non-public pupils accessing shared time services from their public school district. Under current law, public school district programs can provide shared time instruction in the core curriculum at the public school building only. And this provision is intended to broaden that so that core curriculum may be provided to these pupils by sort of online means. not limited to being physically at the public school facility. And there is a cost tracked for this, and it is $319,000 in the first biennium and $889,000 in the second.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative
Stenstead.
Stenstead. Let me see your I'm such a visual learner. Let me see that.
Thank you. I understand. Stenstead. Completely.
I think teachers tend to be that way. Stenstead. Representative Stenstead.
Can you give me a little more maybe idea on how this would look or roll out and the why? What, you know, why would they be doing this right now, especially if it's core curriculum?
This is how we're returning to what had been current law, and also we live in an era where people really do expect to get services, especially online services. Well, I'll tell you how it came about. One of our senators actually had a complaint because he had a daughter who was taking this core curriculum, but she had to go to the actual school building to go online to take the course. So it didn't seem to make sense that to take an online core curriculum course, you actually have to go sit in the school building. And so I believe that was the genesis of this. And I'm told that this is also what current law was at one point. And there could be other pieces as well. Okay. And it is to note, the payment is to the public school that is serving that student. So the payment is to the serving school.
Do you have any more information, Madam Chair, or any other members, on what type of facility, non-public school, would be offering core curriculum instruction in this way?
Oh, I think the clarification is that it's the public school that's offering the core curriculum instruction. And the student chooses to take that. The private school student chooses to take that core curriculum, okay, which is currently covered. The question is, do they have to go to the site to do that, as opposed to being able to do that, if it's an online course, online? And as I said, the payment is to the public mm-hmm. school. Is there a further discussion on that or additional clarification? Rep. Sandstein?
No, I'm good. Thank
okay.
you.
Yep. Anyone else? All right. Next, reorient us where we are.
Madam Chair, members, at the bottom of page R28, House Section 36 is a provision that requires that applies beginning July 1st, 2019, and will require that the a process be created for evaluating grants. And essentially, the grant requires grant goals to be aligned with the world's best workforce and Minnesota's ESSA plan, and requires applicants for any grants awarded by MDE to include strategies that they would use to meet the goals and how they would plan to measure the effectiveness of the strategies that they're proposing with the grant that they hope to receive. And then the provision requires that the grant recipient report to the commissioner and to the legislature on the effectiveness of their individual strategies.
Mr. Arneson.
Madam Chair, on page R29, Senate Section 26, just strikes obsolete language. The aid for litigation costs under 125A75 Subdivision 9 hasn't been paid or available for many years, so strikes this obsolete language, and this identical language is carried in the supplemental bill last year as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, on the bottom of page R29, Section 37 of the House also intends to clarify a reference, this to the current year special education entitlement. You can see here the shift that we were talking about earlier regarding the portion that the state budget surplus, if any, would reduce. You can see here the 97.4%. That's the provision that's currently coupled with the 90% shift. So the special ed shift, instead of being 90-10, is really 97.4% of 90%. Madam Chair, members, on page R30, section 38, is another provision related to the abatements program. A couple of technical clarifications and name changes are made here. The intent was to hold this revenue neutral but correct for the programs that have equalization aid and should be factored into the abatement formula. Madam Chair, members, at the bottom of page R31 on the House side, this is the second provision related to the foster care changes carried in the House bill. And this requires that the Department of the Commissioner of Human Services to report on school enrollments and how many of those occur within 7 days of a student being placed in a foster care home.
Mr. Strom, is there a cost for that report?
Madam Chair, members, we're not aware of a fiscal note being attached to this provision.
Thank you. Mr. Arneson.
Madam Chair, on the bottom of page R31 is a Senate-only provision, and this would provide that for 2 years only, the Carlstead Elementary School in the Tri-County District is eligible to generate elementary sparsity aid. My understanding is that the agency had been paying this aid based on Carlstead Elementary School's distance from, distance-based formula in the law. And Carlstead Elementary School was near to the threshold but didn't actually qualify. And the agency paid it for a period, and this would extend the payment for another couple of years to allow Tri-County District to bridge to some new budget system that would account for the reduction in aid. And the cost on this is $147,000 in the first biennium and $8,000 in the second biennium. Madam Chair, the next two provisions are quite similar between the two bodies, and for the most part, I believe the differences are purely technical. And this would require the formation of a pupil transportation working group. Both bodies establish duties for the working group, indicate who is a member of the working group, require the Commissioner of Education to convene the first meeting, and provide administrative support to the working group, clarifies the compensation and per diem payments are not allowed for the working group, requires a report from the working group, and requires the 2020 legislature to review the recommendations and encourage to convene a legislative study group to develop its own recommendations for legislative changes as necessary.
Madam Chair, members, on the top of page R34 is the second half of the state budget surplus provision related to the permanent school fund. This sets the distribution mechanism in place for the $50 million that would come out of future state budget surpluses. On our current estimate of the pupil counts, that would amount to $57.08 per pupil across all school districts and charter schools. And that payment could stretch over a period of years until the full $57.08 is reached.
And where is that in the order of payment options? So when we have a budget reserve, we itemize, I think the first thing would go to a school. Had there been any kind of a school shift? And I think earlier in the House language had added an option 6. Where does this fall? Is this option 7, option 6? Where is that?
This is option 6, and that would fall in the 6th priority. If you turn all the way back to page R1, you can see those current priorities. On line 3.3, the cash flow account, which has been satisfied, is at $350 million. the budget reserve itself, there's a second provision on this, but you can see the number burned in statute there is $1.596 billion. That's actually a little over $2 billion now, as there's a separate provision that dedicates one-third of any surpluses to that budget reserve account. So that number in statute on 3.6 really is about a $2 billion number. That's the second priority. The third and fourth priorities are the school payment shifts, should there be any. Currently, there aren't any shifts there, so third and fourth are those two payments. The fifth, you can see the existing language has been stricken. That Clean Water Fund was actually funded through that, so that $22 million is no longer necessary. So the new number five becomes the special education payment, which would be $37 million of the future surplus. And then after that's reached, then the next priority would be priority six, the $50 million.
Mr. Strom, I'm still, let's go back just a little bit on that. I just wanted to talk a little bit about that provision, which is section 41, the permanent school fund compensation aid. And so we're putting dollars into the corpus. Is that correct? Am I reading?
Madam Chair, no. This would be a one-time payment to the districts, not money to the corpus of the fund.
So it's one-time money to the districts, okay? And how do we know then what those payout amounts are?
Madam Chair, the payout to each district would be that $58 I just mentioned, but it might be spread over more than 1 year. Should there not be a $50 million surplus all at one time? So. If there were a $25 million surplus this year, for example, then that'd be about $25 per pupil. And then if it were 3 years later that there were another surplus, then the remaining amount of that $58 would come that year.
Is there any so when it come to the school trust lands, there's that corpus that we put money into. And, of course, the problem with the school trust lands is that in the past, those have not been used according to the requirement that they be used for the highest and best use as far as generating revenue for our school students. And there are some who have proposals to pay that back. And it's a significant amount of money. And my question is, how does this permanent school fund compensation aid affect the backlog due to the school trust lands corpus because of not using those school trust lands according to highest and best use?
Madam Chair, perhaps it's best for the members to speak to this.
Oh,
I mentioned, this was a floor amendment, so there wasn't a House hearing on that. But if I could impute some intent to the member, I think the goal was to say that because the land was not used to its highest and best use in the past, that there should be a payment for that to the school districts to make that up. And instead of that being money put into the corpus, it'd be a one-time payment to the districts.
And so I think my question then, and maybe to the members, mm-hmm. it's a better question, thank you so much, would this payment then go towards repaying the school trust lands?
Madam Chair, if you mean would this payment go towards a deposit in the corpus, my understanding is no. This money goes straight out to districts.
Yes. Chair Dabney, yes. And then my bigger question is also kind of this accounting piece where we have not use those school trust lands to highest and best use, and so there's this backlog of dollars due to the safe school and trust lands. And my question would be, if in fact there were some sort of school trust land compensation aid, there should be some credit for that aid given that would apply to what the state owes for that misuse of school trust land. So in the Senate side, we've seen bills and proposals to actually repay the school trust lands mm-hmm. for that. And there's a number I can't recall. Does someone remember what number that is? It was in a...
In the root bill?
Yeah. So, Mr. Arneson, so what was that number that... the school trust lands had been underpaid by misuse of land, and so it was still being an obligation of the state. So my question would be, and we can continue this later, but that you would think that if there was a some sort of fund compensation aid, it should be credited towards repaying that misuse, the lack of funding because of the trust lands misuse.
You know, Madam
Chair. We'll just set.
Yeah, I don't know that. We did not in the House consider the question about whether the school trust lands are owed a debt. So crediting this against a debt that we hadn't considered is just a question we didn't entertain.
Thank you. That's a discussion we can have in another point. But thank you, Mr. Strom. And where are we next?
Madam Chair, the next section is the appropriations section. I think for expediency today, perhaps what we should do is only a mention an appropriation if there's a rider that otherwise wasn't implicated when the fiscal analyst went through the tracking sheet and not read through each subdivision of the appropriations, if that's all right with the Chair. So, Madam Chair, then that would bring us past the appropriations to the repealer. And the repealer in the House bill, I'll speak for the House bill, and Senate staff can speak for the
page R36, members.
Yes, thank you. The Senate repealers on the House side, two provisions, one related to the $300 transfer to local optional revenue. And the second provision is there's some relatively old language directing the Commissioner of Education to purchase annuities for certain employees as part of the governor's bill. The House picked up the language that the governor recommended to do away with that authority so that those employees would be eligible for benefits through the state retirement system in the same way as all other state employees.
Thank you. Mr. Arneson.
And, Madam Chair, the Senate repealers pick up both House repealers and also a couple extra. The first one, 123.26, is authority for a school district to request payment to third parties. And this is in the supplemental bill last year, and the agency indicated that even though this authority has been on the books for a while, no district has ever requested it. And so it was recommended for repeal and cleanup. The repealer of 125A.75, subdivision 9, is a special education litigation costs report. It's our understanding that any litigation costs are already reported on the agency's uniform accounting system. And this report only duplicates data that's already easily available. The repealers of 126C.16 subdivisions 1 and 3 are old and obsolete language related to conversion of earlier referendum allowances quite a long time ago. And then the remaining repealers are identical to the House proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. Members, are there any further questions or discussion points on Article 1? I just had one that we went by that I don't believe we talked about in the Senate, and that had to do about with abatement payments, and I can't recall where that is, maybe R38? No, R30, Section 38. R30. If someone in the House can maybe just talk a little bit about those abatements and what that is exactly. It is on R30, members, Section 38.
Madam Chair, members, House Section 38 on the left side of page R30 has to do with the abatement revenue formula. Let me just give you a little brief background on abatements and then talk about the formula and the formula change. School districts essentially are partially funded through state aid and partially through the local levy. And if the local levy is not paid for some reason or another, most often that happens when there's a change in valuation after the levy has been certified. This can happen either because of a change in value that's been requested or in some cases, and you've probably heard about the provisions related to the Enbridge pipeline in northern Minnesota. If those changes in valuation are court ordered after the fact, after the levy's been certified, then essentially what happens is the levy is abated. For school districts, this would be a loss of revenue for them were there not an abatement formula in place. So what the abatement formula does is it tells school districts, if you have a share of your levy abated, if some property tax has been removed or some tax base after the levy has been certified has been removed from the tax base, you can levy that back over a period of 3 or fewer years. In addition to that, the state formula says, and by the way, there probably would have been an 8 impact if you'd really been more property poor than what we were guessing when we did equalization. So the provision that's being amended in the bill is how the abatement aid portion of that's calculated. And what it basically says is if that tax base had not been there, you would have been more property poor as a school district, and so you should have gotten a larger share of equalization aid for each of the equalization aid formulas. So what's changing here is not the amount of the aid or the levy or the application or the timelines of the abatement aid or levy, but simply updating references. For example, if you look on line 32.5, you can see the reference in the abatement statute still referred to health and safety revenue. Well, that had been replaced a few years ago by the long-term facilities maintenance revenue. So really the correct reference there should be the long-term facilities maintenance program, not the health and safety program. So the intent with this change is just to essentially update it to match current law. There's no aid or levy differences expected, but it's intending to make the abatement formula reflect the practice of how that aid and levy should be calculated.
Thank you. How much do we pay in abatement aid?
Madam Chair, there are lines on your spreadsheet for the abatement aid and levy, and I don't remember. I think it's spread out throughout the funds. I think it's about $3 million in aid and 12 in levy, but I could be wildly off. And by the time I get done baloneying you here, the fiscal analyst will have the right numbers for us.
Representative Yuki.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Weber can help me on this. I'm trying to dust off my old city council hat. Isn't when we do abatements, when we use that tool in the toolbox, don't all parties already have to sign off on it, right? If I can remember right, different from TIFs?
Well, yes, we can only abate our respective share, yes.
Yeah. So this is just the districts have already signed off. Mr. Strom, the districts have already signed off on this levy, and it's just we're helping fill that.
Well, Madam Chair, members, there's a whole different discussion about that abatement for economic development, and there's a separate line item for that. What happens for cities and counties when there's an abatement of this style for school districts, when that property goes away, essentially the county treasurer's got to write a check to, if the property owner is successful in a suit like this, they say, oops, we taxed you too much. Here's the money back that we overtaxed you. And the county then, because they're not subject to the rigid levy limits that school districts do, then decides how it's going to levy that back over any scale that it wants. Now, there are obviously issues in some of the communities that might be affected by very large abatements about that levy falling to the other taxpayers to replace that. But with the school formula, because the schools are subject to the levy limits and because of the equalization, the idea behind the abatement formula was to say you're held harmless, essentially, for anything that happened to the tax base after you certified your levy.
And then one further just discussion point on that. And you mentioned Enbridge. So do we anticipate with the change, any changes in the Enbridge pipeline, do we anticipate any changes? And was there any kind of a fiscal note that anticipated such?
Madam Chair, I think both tax committees on the House and Senate side have heard a fair amount about the Enbridge issue this year. This is with their existing lines, mm-hmm. The abatement of the value on how the Commissioner of Revenue values pipeline property in the state, and there's some court cases underway on that, but Clearwater and some of the other counties up there are quite nervous about how that will play out. And even with this abatement formula in place, the school district's tool to restore that money to its budget is additional levy, but when that value is of such proportion that the levy falls on the other taxpayers to a huge extent, there may be need for a change on the school side as well for that particular circumstance should the pipeline companies prevail on the valuation challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. So at the moment, does our spreadsheet show any increased? Was this a change item on our spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, members, no. The February forecast best guess on abatements is unchanged by that, as I understand it, and there's still appeal underway on those valuation decisions.
Do we have any insight, assuming that the court, that the decision is such that abatement would be affected here or be applicable in this case? Do we have any even a idea on how much that might impact the state budget for education? Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, I've not seen an estimate of that. We can check with both the Department of Revenue and Department of Education and see if they've got a contingent number worked up on that. I'm not aware of what that'd be. It's a relatively big deal for some relatively small counties. Statewide, the impact may not be real large, but it could still be significant, I would guess.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for the discussion. Okay. Reorient us. Where are we on Article 2? Any further questions, members? Let's go to Article 2 then.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Go ahead, please. Yes.
Article 2, Section 1, we're on page R1A2. So Article 1, I'm sorry, Section 1 on the House side adds school district or charter school students in foreign exchange or study of abroad programs to the current statute that governs students in travel abroad programs. Sections 2, 3, and 4 continue the change in the compulsory instruction requirements that Mr. Strom referenced earlier. So Section 2 lowers the age of compulsory instruction to begin at 6. You'll see that also in Section 3, and then Section 4 makes a conforming change in the language on assessments. Section 5 on page R4, that's reports to the superintendent. Again, that's also reflecting a change in the compulsory instruction requirements.
And before we leave the compulsory requirements, what was the House's reason to change that compulsory requirement to 6? I believe we're at age 7 now, if I'm not mistaken, current law. And so what was the House thinking behind changing that compulsory attendance number? It's probably Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really what that was, and I had a discussion with MDE2 and our school districts, is kind of catching statute up to what's already happening. About 98% of our kids are starting now that we have all-day K, with all-day K. So just kind of getting that compulsory age set to what's actually happening in the real world.
Chair Youakim, and that was the number that I had, too, that was like 98% already. And so, but then my question is, what's the impact of, you know, going after the other 2%, the remaining 2% of 6-year-olds who for some reason are not in school? And so just what was your thoughts along that line?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had that discussion, too, because I also left in the language when I drafted the bill that parents can still opt out if they feel their child isn't mature enough to start at 6, and then also leaves in place the provision where a school board, if they do a different, if they create a different policy within their school district, that trumps what the state is too. So if a district decided, no, you know what, we want to just leave it at 7, they can.
So some local decision making there. And then lastly, what was the fiscal impact on this? I mean, so we tracked obviously more students then. What is the fiscal impact of changing that compulsory
age?
There was no
meaningful fiscal note on it, just because we have such high numbers now. I think back when the conversation started, maybe Senator Rieger might know better than I, about 10 years ago, there was more of a fiscal impact because we didn't have all-day K, but now that we do, it's negligible because we're at 98%.
So it's more of a statement than actually any type of inactionable policy change or fiscal change.
Exactly.
Thank you. Any further discussions? Yes, Chair Pinto. We have three House chairs here. I'm Okay.
It's a big,
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a big chamber. and actually, this is a good reference, though, because, in fact, I was going to speak in my capacity as Chair of Early Childhood. This provision did not pass through our committee, but I guess I do view it as being, because, of course, you know, we could, if we set the age at 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, presumably 98 or 99% of kids would still be attending, right? So we sort of have to set it at any particular age. But I do view it as a statement of recognizing that, and certainly we saw this in many respects in the House bill and the Senate bill as well, right, of getting kids off to a great start even at the very youngest ages. So recognize that at least by age 6, we really do have an expectation that kids are going to be receiving an education, and that of course, has benefits. We've talked about the cost, has benefits to all of us. And so I view that as being really consistent with the approach we've taken in our committee as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So we have about 60,000 kindergartners, maybe every grade level, about 60,000 kids, so 2% of that. Mm-hmm. So how many kids are we talking about, and how is this going to impact their parents? Chair Yuki.
Madam Chair, I don't want to make assumptions for those 2% of parents, but I'm assuming there's some reasons why they're keeping them at home and they'd still be able to do that.
Thank you. Okay. Further discussion. All right. Let's continue on then. I think we are with the superintendents. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Section 5 on the reports of the superintendents is still part of that change in compulsory instruction. It's just updating the change from age 7 to 6.
So, Madam Chair, members, we're over on R5, the first Senate section in Article 2. And Section 1 allows for a charter school or school district to adopt a locally developed composite-based education plan. Then Section 2, which is further down on R5 onto R6, changes the credits required for graduation and requires a student to earn a credit in government and government or citizenship course in grade 11 or 12.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Ms. Perro.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Section 6 on the House side, that's at page R6. Modifies the world's best workforce requirements for school district plans and budgets. It amends requirements regarding access to culturally relevant or ethnic studies curriculum, inexperienced and effective or out of field teachers, and inclusive and respectful environments, and retaining qualified racially and ethnically diverse staff. There's also a requirement, if you look on the House's line, line 43.23 on page R7, and it requires a school district to submit to the Commissioner of Education the district's world's best workforce plan, and requires the Commissioner to review each of those plans. Section 7, continuing with the world's best workforce, requires the District Advisory Committee to recommend to the school board strategies to ensure the curriculum and learning and work environments are inclusive and respectful toward all racial and ethnic groups.
And, just one question on the previous section regarding the world's best workforce. And I know our school districts are very cautious whenever we require them to do something. And I was just curious if there had been any response from the school districts on this provision as far as adopting the plan and the budget and the requirements. Had there been any, was that in your committee, Chair Yuking?
Madam Chair, this, I believe, and I'm trying to remember, this is part of the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Act that we picked up that was basically sheer policy. We put that in there to show support for a program that I know that you were a huge, I should say, founder of that in 2017. So we had put that in there as policy, and we didn't hear anything from the districts, if I can remember right, but I could always phone a friend if we had to.
I'm sure we will. If there's an issue, I'm sure we'll hear. I just know that we always want to be so careful of any kind of unfunded mandates on our school district. So thank you. Okay. Ms. Perro.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'm just trying to remember where I was. Oh, I think I was on Section 8. That's page R8. And that requires a school district to screen for characteristics of dyslexia. All students not reading, identified as not reading at grade level by the end of kindergarten, grade 1 and 2. And then from grades three and up, the district would screen students who demonstrate a reading difficulty unless there's already another reason that's been identified for the student having that reading difficulty.
And to that, kind of that same line of thinking, the Senate has been a huge supporter of dyslexia training for our teachers, both pre-service and after service. And I had a question on the screening aspect of it regarding, is there a fiscal note for this? Is a cost, I believe, to our school districts, some concern there regarding a unfunded mandate? And I just was hoping, is that, Chair Youakim, was that your committee as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This actually was a provision that a few of our members sat down and worked with the entire coalition between the dyslexia folks and the school districts and our AMSC, MSBA, and they had like a two-hour conversation and came to this language. So it was kind of a peace in the valley language.
And thank you. And was there, you must have the fiscal note that shows what the local note would be to our school districts, what the cost would be to our school districts?
I'm looking over at Ms. Hendrians. There was one.
Madam Chair and members, I don't believe we currently have one, but I can double check.
Oh, sure. And if you could ask for one, it might not have been part of your fiscal note. I thought our fiscal notes did include both local notes as well as state costs, but let's make sure we know. Certainly very worthwhile. You know, one out of five of our kids does have dyslexia, and with a specific training, we know that these kids are great kids, great readers. And maybe I'll just take a moment, since we're on this dyslexia piece, to tell you a little bit about one of my interns last year, actually. He was a terrific intern, a student at St. Olaf, and he brought in some writing into my office one day. And I said, wow, I said, this is terrific writing. I was just really blown away by excellent writing and understanding the subject so well. And I just casually mentioned to him, I said, you know, you must have had a great teacher somewhere along the line. You must have had a terrific teacher, a writing teacher. And he just looked at me and he said, well, Senator Nelson, you need to thank the Reading Center, which is the Reading Center, which is the Minnesota Dyslexia Center dealing with dyslexia. And so it is true that we want to make sure that our students are getting the specific teaching and training early on. It's harder to teach a kid to read after third grade when they decide they're non-readers. So very important. So thank you for that discussion, and I'll look to make sure that we know if there is a local cost to our school districts. Thank you. Okay. Are we with Mr. Arneson?
Madam Chair, members, now we're back to the Senate side in Section 3. The heading starts at R8, but the actual operative language is on R10, which directs a school district to provide access to secondary students, same access to military recruiters and representatives of skilled trades and manufacturing, give them the same access as higher education institutions have to the secondary students, as well as encouraging the district to sponsor an armed forces career opportunity day. Then section 4 at the bottom of R10 is a direction to the Commissioner of Education to collaborate with the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to incorporate construction and skilled trades into the career counseling services. And I believe this one has a fiscal cost.
Madam Chair?
Yes. The fiscal cost? Ms. Hofer?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This provision combined with a provision you'll see later about a report is $150,000 in the 2021 biennium.
Thank you. And I saw another question here. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back on the giving military recruiters the same access as others, I know that there's a federal law that is similar to this, and I'm just wondering how this provision builds upon that, or what the difference is compared to that federal requirement. If anybody knows, and we may not know now, but
And which federal law are you speaking with? I'm sorry, I was listening to a couple different things here.
I don't know that I have the site. I could probably bring it up. But my understanding is that there's a requirement that schools give military recruiters the same access to students as they do to other recruiters. Oh, I'm sorry. The federal law. Madam Chair, I can look that up and then provide that. We can take a look and see how it compares.
Let's take a look at that. And it might be the same thing as we talked about with the ballots as well. That would have been my understanding, too. But now, this has been a few years ago, but I was a volunteer in a career center in one of our local high schools, and I was stunned to find out that military recruiters could not come to the high school. So it's a good point for us to find out.
Let's take a look.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, when I taught, which I guess was a while ago now, but at least 15 years ago, I thought we still had military recruiters in our school. When did this change?
Chair Erdahl, I'm trying to think. When I was, before I was teaching, would have been in the late 90s is when I was doing some volunteer work. I can't speak to that, but I do think it's an important issue to make sure that our schools and our students do have access to those military recruiters, just like any other career areas. And we'll get some more information on that. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that, because for most of my 35 years in the classroom, we regularly had military recruiters in the school. And I'm just wondering if it'd be good if somebody could come up with when this changed.
Yes. And, it's so wonderful that we have the world of knowledge in our little palms here.
I've got it right
and
there.
My staff is showing, we do, there is easily to be found requirements regarding higher education institutions allowing military recruiters. We can't at this very moment put our fingers on if that includes our K-12 systems, but
Chair
Pinto.
I can give you assistance with that, Madam Chair. It's okay. 20 U.S. Code Section 7908, and appears to be Clause A3, which provides that each local educational agency, so local schools receiving federal assistance, quote, shall provide military recruiters the same access to secondary school students as is provided to institutions of higher education or to prospective employers of those students. And it looks like that tracks the Senate language pretty identically at lines 29.9 to 29.12, except that your language does provide access to representatives as organizations promoting careers in the skilled trades and manufacturing. So actually, interestingly, it seems like this is sort of a skilled trades and manufacturing provision as much as a military provision in that it duplicates the law.
There are actually two different bills.
Oh.
So they just happen to fall in the same line. So
I see, yeah.
One bill deals with the military recruiters, and one adds construction careers to our career planning.
And it does, Madam Chair, track the federal language, it would appear, then, in 20 U.S. Code Section 7908.
Thank you.
Thank
you for that. Any further questions on that? Representative Erdahl?
Thank you. The question is it prohibited now?
It appears not. Chair Yuki?
I thank you, Madam Chair. I can confirm that even though I worked in an elementary school this last year, 2 years before that I worked in a high school, and they still have access, and they can table just like the college or any other organization that comes in. So
with that discussion, I don't know that it's prohibitive to reiterate it. If there has been some cases in the past where there was a difference, I can tell you there was at one point. Perhaps as long as our language is consistent, I do think that's an important piece. Chair Yukin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the one concern I may have with this, and just because we didn't hear it in policy, I would have liked to hear from the counselors on it, because you do have some requirements of counselors being able to, talking to students about it when they have so much on their plate already. I hate to put more mandates on our counselors. It would have been nice to hear from them.
Thank you. We did have a hearing in the Senate, and we did not have any opposition at all. So no one came forward with any concerns. And we'll take a deeper look here at this Senate language. At this point, it's just asking the Commissioners of Education and the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to incorporate construction and skilled trades into career counseling services for middle and high school students. Career advisement should identify high growth, in-demand skilled trades and include information on various career paths and associated jobs, the salary profiles for those jobs, and credentials and training. So it looks like at this point it's asking the two commissioners to collaborate and to come to what this might look like. So maybe that will add some additional clarity there.
Madam Chair,
Chair Dabney.
Is there an appropriation to the department to cover these increased costs?
Yes, there is, and I think our fiscal, I don't want to speak from memory, I think it might be $150,000. We'll let our fiscal analyst give you the exact number.
Madam Chair and committee members, there is an appropriation for the Construction and Skilled Trades Counseling and Report in the bill. It'd be $150,000 to the Department of Education for transfer to the Department of Labor and Industry.
So we're paying the Department of Labor and Industry?
We are paying the Department of Labor and Industry to help impact getting more of our students the career counseling. I think the genesis is we have a workforce crisis, and we have a workforce crisis particularly in some of the construction careers that that pay well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one way to try and make sure that our students are aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
A further discussion. Okay. Let's see. We are on what page here? It looks like section R11, and who would be speaking?
I can start, Madam mm-hmm. Chair.
Ms. Butler.
R11 is the House and Senate both have language for which they are somewhat similar, but mostly different.
We like that.
I'll all about it. Start with the Senate side, or do the Senate side, and Ms. Power can do the House side. But so it's Section 5 of the Senate file, and the language on R11 requires the commissioner to establish a testing period as late as possible in each school year for the administration of the MCAs. And then on lines 30.7 to 30.20, strike some obsolete language regarding testing.
And then to the House side, Ms. Pera.
Madam Chair, members, the House side, if you're on page R11, lines 45.16 to 17 requires the questions on the MCA to be developed by licensed Minnesota teachers. The House also picks up the language regarding the benchmarks, eliminating the benchmarks. And then there's the new paragraph R on page R15 that adds a definition of civic life for purposes of statewide accountability.
And Ms. Carr, did I hear you say it eliminates the benchmarks?
Yes. So if you look on page R14, both the House and Senate strike the requirement that the commissioner establish empirically derived benchmarks on adaptive assessments in grades 3 and 8.
Oh, yes. I think I remember that discussion. This was old language that's been replaced with ESSA language. Is that correct? No.
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. I believe this was a recommendation by the OLA from a couple of years ago when the OLA did the report on statewide assessments.
Thank you. Any further discussion on this or clarity? Okay.
Madam Chair, the next section is House language, section 10, starting at the bottom of R15. And this eliminates the definitions related to off-grade testing requirements on the MCAs. And Madam Chair, that's a $15,000 savings.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Then
Ms. Butler.
Madam Chair, members, then moving on to Senate Section 6, most of the language is on page R18, and that is about the timing for a school district to send out the individual student performance data and the achievement report to parents and to teachers of each student and have that done 30 days after the test is administered to the student.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. And please chime in if there's any other questions. Ms. Butler?
Then the next section is Section 11 in the House file and Section 7 in the Senate file are the same, and the requirements for the commissioner to implement the value-added growth model, the statutory requirements are stricken, and just allowing the commissioner to do a model versus the statutorily set model, as well as Section 12 in the House file and Section 8 in the Senate file are the same. Those are on R21, and those then strike the references to low, medium, and high growth in the statutorily set growth model.
Ms. Pear.
Madam Chair, Section 13, starting on page R22, this is the first of about 10 or so sections relating to student discipline. So this first one here, Section 13, defines non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices as alternatives to removing a pupil from class or dismissing a pupil from class, and has examples of what some of those are. These policies and practices require school district officials to intervene in, redirect, and support a pupil's behavior before removing a pupil from class or beginning dismissal proceedings. And so that definition is picked up throughout in some of the next provisions I'll be going through. Section 14 defines pupil withdrawal agreements as verbal or written agreements between an administrator and a parent to withdraw a student to avoid expulsion or exclusion dismissal proceedings. And there's a 12-month limit on those. Section 15 requires a school to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before a dismissal proceeding or a pupil withdrawal agreement. And there is an exception if the pupil will create an immediate and substantial danger to self or other persons or property. Section 16 requires a school administrator to ensure that when a pupil is suspended for more than 5 consecutive school days, that student is receiving alternative education services. Section 17 requires school officials to give suspended pupils a reasonable opportunity to complete schoolwork that is assigned during that suspension and receive credit for it, and also encourages a principal to designate a liaison to work with the pupil's teachers to allow that student to receive feedback and complete assignments. Section 18, and we're now on at the bottom of R23, the language is really on R24, that requires written notice, the written notice of intent to exclude or expel, to describe the non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices that were used to try to avoid the expulsion proceedings, and it requires the Department of Education to post on its website a list of legal assistance resources. Section 19 requires an admission or readmission plan to address measures to improve the pupil's behavior, and has some examples of those measures, and also requires parental involvement in the admission or readmission process. Section 20 on page R25 requires a school board to report pupil withdrawal agreements and non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices given to the pupil in response to an assault to the Department of Education. Section 21 requires a school district policy to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. It requires that alternative educational services be provided to a pupil during dismissals, during the dismissal period. It requires for all exclusion and expulsion dismissals and pupil withdrawal agreements that the district keep reviewing the pupil's work and grades to make sure that pupil is on track for readmission, that the pupil remains eligible for school-based mental health services until that pupil is enrolled in a new district, and that the school district provides the parent a list of mental health and counseling services. That is the last of the student discipline provisions. The next one is...
Oh, yes. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd just like a little explanation or more information. Looking for the right the phrase here. If I go, it's actually in Section 13. There's a phrase that says These policies and practices require school officials to intervene in, redirect, and support a pupil's behavior before removing a pupil from class. What does actually support a pupil's behavior actually mean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have all the statutes in front of me, but this language comes from the governor's policy bill, and we had discussion around it in our committee. And it's kind of a, I wouldn't quite call it peace in the valley, but a compromise language around a good balance between teacher, administration, and pupil, and parent, and how you approach if a kid's misbehaving in class. It doesn't touch if a student's violent or in an imminent danger of harming themselves or others. They can still be removed. This just asks the districts and to do what they're already working really hard on along with the Department of Human Rights is to create policies to make sure our kids, if possible, stay in school because that's where they learn best, and then also does policies and procedures if they are taken out of the classroom, how we can continue their education.
Madam Chair, it just seems like, and I realize I'm a fairly literal person, but that phrase, support a pupil's behavior, when that behavior is something perhaps less than it is desired to be, seems to me to be rather strange turn of a phrase.
Chair Yuki.
Sorry, Madam Chair, could you point to that? That's
in section, I'm actually, I think it's
versus
in section 13. And it actually goes down to about two-thirds, it should be on 57.13, starts in 57.12 and goes on to 57.13.
Just finding it here.
R22, line 57.13.
Thank you. I know I cross-referenced a lot of different sections. If you look at the statute, unfortunately, the statute here, 121A.141, has a lot of other stuff that's in it before this, and this just adds a subdivision. So Mm-hmm. Redirect and support a pupil's behavior before. I think what that language is supposed to mean is support, not saying to the, I think you're literally saying, yeah, meaning,
right,
thinking
that's,
it means that you support what the pupil's doing.
Yeah.
No, it's just to support their behavior within the classroom and then remove them if they have to. So I think a lot about what I did as a paraprofessional. I worked in a level 3 program. And we worked really hard to try to keep the kids in the classroom if we could, because a lot of the times they're smart enough to know that their behavior may get them out of the classroom. So having that para support specialist or somebody in there trying to redirect them in the class first before you take them out. So that's where that's headed. But I can get some more clarification from the governor's staff on that policy. But it's more about supporting the people in the classroom as much as you can before you remove them, especially if they're not harming anybody else or others. If it's just, you know, acting out in the class, being able to move them to the back of the room and keep them participating as much as you can with support staff.
Rep. Sancy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would assume it's probably trying to get at appropriate and positive behavior supports for the student. So it's trying to support the student in a positive way and encourage them in positive behaviors or appropriate classroom behaviors, whether it's modeling or doing whatever we can to assist those positive behaviors before taking any kind of disciplinary or exclusionary action.
And I do recall receiving a letter from the Association of Minnesota School Principals and administrators, and they had some concerns about this language. So I thought I might have heard Chair Yukim say there was peace in the valley on this. No, I misunderstood. Okay. There's not peace on the valley on this. There is concern amongst administrators in that how this would impact their ability. It would tie their hands in dealing with student discipline. But I do think everyone agrees that obviously we want our kids in school as much as possible, but there does come a point where keeping that child in the school setting will be disrupting the learning of other students, and also tying the hands of the school professionals. So we'll want to delve into that a little bit more. Chair Yuking.
Yes, Madam Chair, and we did have discussion around, and this a lot of this language focuses around students with disabilities, in the classroom, and the Coalition of Students with Disabilities. I have a letter from PACER talking about this and a few others that I can bring down and explain as well. So it really does, Representative Sandstead said it a lot more eloquently than I did when it comes to that positive intervention strategies, which is also something that teachers have been trained in. Gosh, that's been, what, 10 years old now? Positive intervention strategies of, you know, taking the kid into the back of the room and working with them and seeing, like, do you want to try that again, or that modeling good behavior instead of always saying, you're out.
Yes. Do we think teachers do that? I'm that teachers would just immediately, you know, send students out of the classroom?
Madam Chair, luckily not in a lot of the schools that I work in, but
that's not my experience either. And we've had, I think you mentioned that, you know, some of our students with disabilities do have that additional para support that comes right into the classroom with them. So, okay, more discussion on that to come. It sounds like further discussion on that piece. All right. I believe we're – Ms. Perro, did you make it through all of that?
Madam Chair, I made it through all the student discipline provisions. Yes. So we are now in Section 22, and that's page R26. That is the student journalism and student expression section. Subdivision 1 defines various terms, including school-sponsored media, student journalist, student media advisor. Section 2 states that a student, I'm sorry, subdivision 2, states that a student journalist has a right to exercise freedom of speech and freedom of the press in school-sponsored media, and it prohibits a school district or charter school from disciplining a student journalist for exercising these rights. It prohibits the district or charter school from retaliating against a student media advisor or for supporting a student journalist exercising free speech rights, and it states that the section does not inhibit a student media advisor from teaching professional standards of English and journalism to students. Subdivision 3.
Before we leave, are you still on the student journalism piece?
Madam Chair, yes. Just in subdivision 3.
Okay.
Which lists expression that is not protected by this section. And subdivision 4 requires districts and charter schools to adopt and post student journalist policy consistent with this section.
Thank you, Ms. Perro. We did have some comments and concerns on this provision as well. Again, I don't have the information with me, but I believe it was, again, from the school administrators and superintendents regarding concerns students having boundaries while in school but still wanting to include and encourage, of course, freedom of speech, but within there were some concern about writings that could be cause the school district to be liable if there were known falsehoods or known inaccuracies or other types of instances. So I think we'll need to delve into that just a little bit further. It doesn't seem to be that there's a peace in the valley on this particular provision yet. I think everyone agrees with the goal, but are a little bit concerned about some of the implementation pieces. Chair Youakim.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what you're describing really is falls under the unprotected speech, so none of that would be protected if it was false, libel, slanderous, disruptive of the school day, inciting a riot, and quite a few other things.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of control the districts still have. And then we adopted some really good amendments from Representative Krisha on the floor. I think both of them were from Representative Krisha. One that requires it to be taught by a licensed teacher. So then there is some more control over that environment. And then also another one that allows students to have political freedom when it comes to putting stuff on the editorial page so that they can't be prohibited or banned from expressing their political viewpoint, whatever side of the aisle that's on. So we did some good work on the floor on it as well.
Oh, so it's quite possible the concerns we have predated the floor work, so we'll maybe get some folks in here and see if those concerns have been addressed. Great. Further discussion? Ms. Butler.
Then, Madam Chair, members, that takes us to the bottom of R27, Senate Section 10,
And that allows a school district that has adopted a composite-based education plan to use that plan as a appropriate evaluation of pupil progress and promotion. Excuse me.
And, Madam Chair, Section 23 of the House language on page R28 is another one of these kindergarten provisions, and this one requires a school board to provide kindergarten free of charge to eligible children in the district. That's already, the state already pays for all-day kindergarten. Section 24 and 25, Section 24 on the House side and Section 11 on the Senate side, those are very similar. Those relate to PSEO and modifies the accreditation requirement for an Opportunities Industrialization Center.
And Ms. Perro, just back on Section 23, I'm assuming, or maybe to your fiscal analyst, Mr. Strom, there's no fiscal impact then of that section, since we already are providing free kindergarten. Just clarification on that. Thank you, Ms. Adrian.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Madam Chair, I believe, let me just skip. We went through the PSEO. Okay, yes.
I think we're, okay. Ms. Butler.
Madam Chair, members, and I think we're on the top of R29, Senate Section 12, and that's the at this point, a first of some sections on the PTEC, but this one allows a 9th or 10th grade student that's enrolled in a concurrent enrollment course or to be enrolled in a concurrent course if it's part of the PTEC program. Then Section 25 of the House file and Section 10 of the Senate file, which is actually from Article 1, Section 10, are the same. And they allow for a or require a school district to notify students, of the PSEO opportunities at a date before registration for the following school year. Then Section 13 of the Senate file is another PTEC section, which excludes those schools from the limits on the post-secondary enrollment options program.
Representative Sanson.
I apologize for the interruption. I just have some questions around PTEC in general. That's not something I'm very familiar with. If you could tell me a little bit about it. I know that it's kind of a movement maybe growing in other states. What do you see as being the benefit in Minnesota? Does it benefit all Minnesota students? Is it going to be specific to maybe just a certain region or area? Has there been a request from Minnesota businesses? As I understand, it might be a business partnership.
Sure. I'll be glad to give you just a real brief overview, and then I think we'll have next week we'll probably have a more in-depth piece on that. But you're correct, Rep. Sandsteed. It is a partnership between a public school, a community college, and a business and industry partner. There's a formal partnership where the students grades 9 through 12 plus years 13 and 14 receive hands-on internships, apprenticeships, mentorships, working with the industry partner as well as the public high school and the community college. It has been highly successful in other states. It's no cost to the students. The students are first in line for jobs with that industry partner. Most of these schools are, let me tell you what it stands for. PTEC is Pathways in Technology, Early College High. Most of the schools are a school within a school. There's, I think, only one or two standalone PTEC sites nationally. Started in New York and has grown into other states as well, because what they've seen is a lot of times our PTEC schools work with students who would be considered our at-risk students, and they've seen tremendous results. Four times the graduation rate, two times the rate of completing that industry credential or an AA degree. And I actually don't want you to write the numbers down because I might have been, I'm speaking from the top of my head here, except to say that the results have been stellar. I particularly like the fact that the industry, I mean, we are in a workforce crisis, and the fact that the industries are stepping up to partner with our schools, I think is a good movement to one, impact their reach, their financial resources, and most importantly, so that our kids are getting the training that they need, and then to come out with those jobs. But we'll hear more about it next week, and I'm sure. Yes, and Ms. Rep. Stancy, more questions.
Am I correct to assume that we currently do not have any PTEC schools in Minnesota currently?
That's correct.
Okay. And has there been an appetite in Minnesota? Has there been a business partner that's brought this forward?
Yes, it's been amazing to me. The business, I was at a meeting for Southeast Minnesota a couple weeks ago, and there's a large number of businesses who are interested, I think because the workforce crisis has really pushed this to the front. And a number of spots, I've heard also community colleges here in the metro area who have contacted me saying, we really want to do this. There's businesses here in the metro area that are interested as well. And so I do believe there's a growing appetite for this, largely because of the workforce crisis and because it works. So we'll know more. You'll get to hopefully many more of your questions answered next week. Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So currently there are no PTEC schools in Minnesota.
That's correct.
And is this a part of a move to encourage them to develop in Minnesota, this provision?
Representative Erdahl, this would allow this type of a PTEC movement within our state. You'll see a number of sections have been adjusted to allow for PTEC, whether it be student aid or PSEO options. But the funding in this bill is for planning and implementation. We know it will be a small starting. I anticipate if, as other states have seen such great success with this, I anticipate that this will continue to grow. And the other nice thing is that in a number of cases, there are multiple businesses that partner with a particular high school, depending on the setting.
Thank you. Do you anticipate, Madam Chair, that there will be increased cost to school districts with new curriculum and new standards or anything like that?
The standards would be the same standards, and I don't know that there would be increased costs. I think that's a good question that we would address, and that we could also look to see how that has impacted other schools. I think one of the differences, of course, is the internships, apprenticeships, mentorships, and some of those are paid internships as well. And probably the key thing is at the end of the it's also, if I understand it correctly, it's also competency-based, where the students can progress at their own pace. So some students would graduate in 3.5 years and some perhaps 6. But we'll know more next week. So I'd say keep your good questions, and we'll talk to someone who has done this in the past next week.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Chair Dabb.
I'm intrigued that you describe it as a school within a school program, because both the local and national advocates, when they've spoken to me about it, described it as new schools in districts and a requirement that schools build new schools to house the program. So that's a significant difference from what I was being told over a period of time.
And I think that's something, again, that we should address next week. But I think the data would show maybe 200 schools, PTEC schools, in the nation, or maybe they're on track for 200 now. I think there's 2 that are standalone schools. So good question.
To hear. How does this compare to Minnesota's youth skills training program? Because it sounds very similar.
I think there could be similarities. And again, I think that's something we can address next week with our testimony, our testifiers, and see. But I do think it could be on a broader scale. And I think there's that kind of special sauce of those 3 partners that have to really mold together.
Which is exactly the use of the screening program model.
Yes, and that runs, I think, through the Department of Labor and Industry,
That's
I believe.
Correct.
Yes. Further questions? All right. We finished up through, Ms. Butler, did you get through the PTAC provisions?
There's more later, but right now I think we were on page R30, House Section 26 and Senate Section 11. People are okay to move on? And the Senate section actually came from Article 1, but the two sections are the same, and it requires a higher ed institution to allow a high school student that's in PSEO to enroll in online courses consistent with that institution's policy. Then again, moving on, then R31 is another PTEC section, and that's about financial aid that a student enrolled in a PTEC course cannot receive state financial aid for that course if they're receiving the secondary credit for it. Then, I think we're on a house file.
Ms. Perro.
Madam Chair, Section 27 on the House side modifies the concurrent enrollment program aid, and the House version makes only technical changes. The Senate modifies Subdivision 3. And I'll let Ms. Butler speak.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, members, Section 15 of the Senate file is allowing a school to receive concurrent enrollment aid for a student that's doing a PTEC school.
Thank you. And then is there one other section on PTEC?
Yeah. Then, Madam Chair, members, starting at the bottom, R31, going on for a few pages is the actual section that establishes PTEC schools. And you can see there that it has the objectives as well as the process for applying for the for grants and to be designated as a PTEC school, and then there's approval process, and then on R33, the end of subdivision 5, where is the actual grants where it supports PTEC schools in startup and ongoing program costs.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Members, we're getting close to the time where some of us have to go back into session, and so we'll stop our walk through here, and hopefully Chair Dabney will continue with our walk through next when you have the gavel. Mm-hmm. But today, I do know we had some questions that we had asked the department that I thought before our time escapes that we should ask. And one of them, I believe the department is here, Mr. Cordy, to answer regarding special education mandates. And Mr. Cordy, welcome to the committee. If you could kindly introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. We were curious about the 2016, I believe the department was required to reduce special education. Was it special education mandates or paperwork by 25%? And I'm just wondering if you can refresh us a little bit about on that 2016 law and then tell us, have we met that 25% reduction? If you could just fill us in on the status as well. Mr. Cordy.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, yes, it was legislation 2016, and I believe the words that were used was reduce the paperwork burden. That wasn't defined in the legislation. We had asked the legislature kindly to clarify that, but ultimately in the bill, that was the language we were left with. We had to take a look at kind of what we have control over. As you know, obviously we can't make changes to federal requirements. We can't make changes that are in state law, and we can't actually even change rules ourselves. We need specific legislative authority to do that. So the one thing that we do have within our control and have flexibility over from the federal government is our program monitoring process. So you're a member for special education. There's kind of a front end and a back end. On the front end, we go in and monitor districts to ensure that their policies and procedures are complying with state and federal law. And then on the back end, we have a complaint process where if a parent feels like their child isn't receiving the services they're entitled to, they can file a complaint with us or engage in other alternative dispute resolution tactics. So we did take a look at our program monitoring cycle. And we changed the cycle from a 5-year to a 6-year cycle. So that's right there, you know, one less year that we're working with districts and on-site and going over policies, procedures, and paperwork. And then we looked at the number of items that we monitor and really try to align the items that we monitor with the things that we get complaints about. So making sure that we're the districts are doing the things that so we can prevent there being complaints in the future. So we substantially reduced the number of items that we monitor by 30%. And so the question is, how does that translate into less paperwork burden? Well, when we review fewer documents, that means that there's fewer citations or things that we can find that they have to correct. So the number of citations that could be assigned to a district were reduced by 43%. So when you have fewer citations, you have fewer corrective actions, and fewer corrective actions means less time that teachers have to spend correcting paperwork that went through the monitoring process. So that's where we focused our work. As a follow-up to that, we knew that there were statutes and rules that were concerning to administrators and districts about paperwork. So I specifically asked MACE to assign a director to meet with me and give me a list of kind of what are the top 5 or 6 special education paperwork items that you would like to see fixed. All of those, for the most part, did require some change in state law, and I would say almost all of those, well, at least 4 out of the 6 that we received are addressed in one way or another in your bills, and those would be the items around having a functional behavioral assessment be a standalone assessment, the changes making a conciliation conference available at the request of a parent, and then the House has a provision about short-term goals and objectives and that those could be eliminated from an IEP with parent consent. The one area where I think we do still have work to do is around prior written notice. We met with advocates and school boards and MACE on this and really determined that it's not something that needs to be fixed in statute or in a rule. It's really a question of the guidance that we provide and how districts are interpreting that guidance. So that's why we're supportive of the provision in the House bill that would create a working group where we can get all the stakeholders around the table, really take a look at our guidance that we have around prior written notice and make sure that the expectations are very clear for districts and what they need to do and that they're not going beyond those requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. I also think it would be helpful to have a list of those federal requirements. We know we can't change. If we could change what the feds do, we'd have them pay that 40% that they promised they would pay for special education. That would be incredibly helpful. And we can't wave a magic wand and make the feds do what we say. But I think it would be important to have a list of those federal requirements that you've identified, that the department has identified, if you could share those with us. And also, you mentioned that there were some rules that needed to be changed, but the legislature needed to change those rules. And have you identified those rules? And I don't know that I've received anything about what rules need to be changed and why. Have you shared that with the legislature yet, Mr. Cordy?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, you know, one of the things that there were two items that I think were more on the rule side, which I believe you've heard some about this year. One was a question of whether or not assessment results are required to be a part of an IEP. Our interpretation of the rule is that it's optional. I believe that you have language in both of your bills that puts it into statute that makes it clear that it's optional. So I think that piece has been addressed by your bills. The other piece that would have that we were looking at rules was, again, around prior written notice. There is some pieces in rule that exceed federal law in terms of the timelines of when a prior written notice needs to be given to a parent. But the content is really what we're talking about here. Is what is the field thinking that MDE is requiring them to include in a prior written notice, and that's where the disconnect is. So I don't think that there needs to be a change in rule. Again, I think it's really a change that we need to work with the stakeholders and come up with guidance that makes it very clear what our expectations are, and so districts aren't going above and beyond that, thinking that that's something we're looking for.
Do you think if we asked our local districts and our special education teachers, would they be able to feel that they've seen a 25% reduction in paper reports?
Madam Chair, members, we have heard from districts that have gone through that monitoring process since we've made the changes that they do appreciate it and that it is a reduced burden. Not all districts have gone through that process yet, so probably not all the districts are feeling that change yet. But we do also appreciate some of the concerns we had or that we hear from them as well. Okay, just because you're not monitoring it now doesn't mean that we don't have to do it. And it doesn't mean that if somebody filed a complaint that we wouldn't have to respond to that complaint, which I totally understand that, which is why I think some of the legislative changes that you all have proposed are good, and we support those.
I think we just have a couple. We have two or three, which we hope have big impact. But my concern is, where do you think we are then in meeting that goal, or I think it was a mandate, to look at how our teachers, how we could reduce 25% of the paperwork, knowing that there's only certain things within the jurisdiction of the Department of Education. But where do you think we are
Madam
towards
Chair,
that goal?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I think in terms of that goal, again, we looked at the things that we have authority over, and we've made reductions of, again, 30% in the items that we monitor and 43% in the possible citation. So in our mind, we have met the mandate that was in that, but we continue to work with our partners and stakeholders around what are other things that we can do to reduce the burden. Well, on the same side, making sure that kids' due process rights are protected.
My special education teachers haven't talked about feeling less paperwork. When I was a special ed teacher, which was a few years ago, paperwork was, well, actually, we filled it out in a triplicate. That's how long ago that was, before computers. But let me just say now, though, our teachers are saying that 25% of their time, 20 to 25% of their time, is working on forms and paperwork instead of working with their students. And I know that's what we're hoping, that we can get our teachers to spend more time, the ability to spend more time with their students. And I see Chair Joachim has a question.
I was just going to say, actually, Madam Chair, MD has been pretty cooperative. When we had really thorough discussions in the House. We have 5 provisions in our bill, and 3 of them, I think, are shared with yours. And this is a concern we've heard a lot, but one thing we also have to remember is there's another part to the equation, and that's the parents and the students affected too. And I think that's why it's really important to have those conversations in committee. It's also very important when it comes to the money side of it that we're making up for the federal money. You're right, we can't wave a wand to make them pay us more, but that's why I'm really proud of the work we've done in our House budget to try to help freeze that gap. But I think it has to be in that context of that whole discussion and making sure the parents are there too.
Thank you. Parents are the number one teachers, for sure. Mr. Cordy, thank you for that report. Just one further question. So I think I understood you to say that MDE is doing fewer reviews and less corrective actions. Is that correct? But I thought the commissioner's letter said that MDE is needing to use more of its existing budget reserves to comply with this instruction from the legislature. So we'll have to go back and look at those letters, but it seems to me that this was one of the things the commissioner said, that MDE was being stretched because they needed to do this, but yet you're doing fewer reviews and less corrective actions. So that should be helpful to the department as well, I would think. Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, yes, we've kind of restructured that division because we're reducing the monitoring side, we are seeing special education complaints and requests for alternative dispute resolution tick up. So really that work has shifted more to the alternative dispute resolution side of the equation.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. And Mr. Cordy, can you answer also, are you the representative here for the department today? I had a question about the scholarships. Can you answer that?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Ricker is here, and
Commissioner.
Might be best suited to answer
I
that.
I can't see you. Oh, you're right behind those chairs, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Oh, thank you, Commissioner. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Of course. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I'm Commissioner of Education.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner. Did I understand your comments correctly regarding the department needing to spend more time because of the special education mandate relief piece?
Madam Chair, thank you.
Yes,
we are understanding that there is still a considerable amount of time that our staff in the special education department is spending on uncovering those compliance measures we are addressing and those that the community in the special needs community is asking us to address. And I can get more details for you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And then the question I had, Commissioner, there's a couple things I was thinking about our discussion yesterday, and it had to do on the scholarships. And so while you're here today, I thought maybe we'd just have time to speak with this. So I was recollecting the numbers, and I think we did some follow-up with your staff as well, mm-hmm. trying to understand how the department was figuring the cost of scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And so our understanding is that the department's figures in determining the Senate proposal, I think if I remember correctly, the comment was that the Senate proposal, which is $44.5 million for scholarships, would have only funded 3,000 of those 4,000 scholarships. Mm-hmm. And yet, when we looked at the math, it just didn't quite work out. And so I'm just wondering if you could explain a little bit how the difference between 44.5 and 50 million would result in a 25% reduction in those pre-K positions. We just couldn't quite make that math work. Commissioner, how did you come to that number?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. So first I want to appreciate Caitlin Schneider, my colleague at the Department of Education, who came to me right away and mentioned that there were some questions about it. And so we worked on the math together. And so Caitlin, do you want to describe how the division we did?
Ms. Snyder, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself for the
Madam
record,
Chair,
please.
Madam Caitlin Chair. Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you so much for the question. I really appreciate it. So the Senate position in front of the conference committee at this point is an annual increase of $22.25 million in fiscal 20 and fiscal 21. This would provide funds at the maximum scholarship award amount of $7,500 of just under.
Say that again, please.
At the maximum scholarship award amount, which is up to $7,500, that would fund approximately 3,000 scholarships.
But that's not the average amount. The average amount of the scholarships is $4,849. So why would you just automatically assume that all of those would be at the maximum cap of $7,500. So a number up, and it kind of depends. I know a number of the scholarships in my area, none of them hit the $7,500 cap. So why would you just assume they all would be at the $7,500 level?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Snyder,
there are some different approaches in how to calculate this, but our the way that we've calculated this is that if the scholarships were awarded at the maximum amount, this would fund approximately 3,000 students in fiscal 20 and fiscal 21.
So that's just assuming everyone's at the maximum cost.
Madam Chair, that would be allowable under current law. So if the intent is that the scholarships not be awarded at the maximum amount, that would have to be addressed in an amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. I think the intent is that they be addressed to, they be allowed to meet the need, whether the average, as I said, is 4,849. So thank you for that clarification.
And Madam
yes,
Chair?
Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do know when Ms. Snyder brought this question to me and she went through the division with me again, I do know that, that we talked about in response to make sure that we shared the math we used with you, that she did make sure to include that if there was another calculation that was going to be commonly accepted, that she asked for that, and I know she did. In the email that she shared with me. So,
oh, terrific. So what would be helpful for us would be the using the average cost, which is $4,849, but I'm sure we can figure that out. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think you've answered all my questions. Commissioner, do you have any other further discussion points to add to the special education paperwork relief effort? I know this predated you as far as the legislation requiring a 25% reduction. I'm just wondering if you have any further comments or insights to add. That is still our goal. That's still the law. We need to see that 25% reduction in paperwork, allowing our teachers to spend more time with their students. I'm just wondering if you have any further clarifications on that or insight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity. First, I want to say that I very much appreciate Assistant Commissioner Cordy sharing from the very beginning the work that had predated me, so I better understand the effort that has gone into this point, and then the special education staff at the Minnesota Department of Education also sharing with me some of the methodologies they used, some of the community engagement they used as well, and then I've had the opportunity since to also talk to different members of the community and the special needs community to find out how to make sure that we have families at the table, other advocates at the table, everybody who has a vested interest in making sure that our paperwork is preserved to make sure that we are institutionalizing that relationship we have and the teaching and learning conditions our students need, and at the same time that we are freeing up paperwork where we can, and we are clearly communicating with families where we must do that as well. So I appreciated the discussion today, and I know that my staff has committed to me that they're going to keep walking through that investigation opportunity, and I know Assistant Commissioner Cordy has been incredibly helpful in walking through what's happened up until this point as well as the opportunities that policymakers have had to debate this session and move forward with some proposals as well.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. Members, are there any further comments or questions for the Commissioner? We're so glad you're here today.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. So, members, we're nearing the time where some of us need to be on the floor, or at least we think the Senate's going in at 4:30. Senator Wicker.
Yes, Madam Chair, just a quick question regarding tomorrow. I believe we're posted at noon, and the Civility Caucus or group, Representatives Wolgenot and Zerwas, Senators Lane and Pratt, they've worked so hard, and it's their final get-together at noon. I'm wondering if we could possibly start at 12:15 or 12:20. We could all be there. Many of you have in the past. If not, so be it. But it's their final gathering tomorrow at noon.
So, Senator Dabney.
Senator Wicker, I've got bad news. The lunch was today. You missed out on the sandwiches. You missed out on the tacos. the macaroni salad. All gone.
You know, I went to that lunch, too, today, and by the time I got there, there were no paper plates left and no tacos left. So I thought it was the same lunch. So we are sorry that you totally missed it. They may have a redo for you, Senator Wicker.
They have our own tomorrow.
Madam Chair,
there's no leftovers.
There never is. My ears perked up when you talked about our reviewing the PTEC language in your bill next week. And does that mean you do not see us as arriving at a completed bill by the 13th as the joint targets stipulate?
Oh, Chair Dabney, I think that would be wonderful. I always have a plan B in my back pocket. It'd be terrific if we had our joint targets this evening, mm-hmm. and we could mm-hmm. wrap this up right away. I think today's, I really appreciate the committee and the testifiers and all the members who really helped us get a better understanding of the differences in our bills and why we might have those. If we don't have our joint budget targets and we're not ready to go, we are prepared for next week as well. And so with that, members, this meeting is adjourned. And Chair Davney, if you would state when our next meeting is.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, and the public, noon tomorrow in back in this room. We will complete the walkthrough and then focus on the early childhood, both finance and policy provisions in the two bills.
Thank you. This meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.